rising temperatures and a longer growing season are pushing the Corn Belt north. These changes, plus advances in science and tech, mean crops are growing in places they never have before.
In some of these places, it's really striking how much the climate has changed the capacity to farm.
Since 2009, they've been mapping every farm field in Canada every year. So you can look at soybean acreage in the Western Prairies that are pretty high north, and you can see how that's just exploded.
In some of these places, the growing season is extended by up to a month. It's become an opportunity for some of the big grain trading and processing companies like Bunge and Cargill to look at the map and figure out where they need to be to process and transport crops over the next few decades.
And land investors are taking notice.
And so we invest in areas in Canada where we're looking for both productivity gains on the same crops and areas that will support either more calorie crops and more profitable crops over time. The biggest examples of those would be soybeans and corn.
Giant agricultural companies like Bayer, DowDuPont, and Syngenta are tinkering with crop genes and crunching data to develop plants that can take the heat and thrive on less moisture.
How do we develop varieties that are resilient for the future? And I think the two themes maybe to focus on today would be drought tolerance and then disease resistance.
Because climate researchers say rising temperatures mean farmers must also deal with more pests, diseases, and storms.
Climate change leading to either more drought, but also at times deluge and a lot of water. The variability in pathogens that show up in our crops these days is higher than ever.
From the cornfields of northern Canada to data-driven plant factories augmented with robots and AI. This is the third episode of the Wall Street Journal series, The Price of Climate.
The Future of Everything, a look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
This is all farmland as far as the eye can see. It's kind of incredible. We're so far north here. I'm as far north as Juneau on the map.
I'm driving to meet a farmer in a remote part of northwestern Canada.
It's interesting. Instead of a cloud line, you have kind of a smoke line off in the distance here. Can see how that's a problem and why they warned me about it in terms of visibility out here.
The fires are making way for more farmland, burning up the remains of what used to be forests.
Time and again, I see these funny structures in the snow. It's like just these piles with all these pokey bits coming up out of the snow, and you realize this was a forest, and really not that long ago. The stumps haven't been dug out yet or anything like that. And then right next to it, you see smooth farmland. Like right now, I'm looking at what is clearly farmland with a little bit of snow, the same as you would see in Illinois or Iowa. A little bit hoarse from the smoke up here.
There's not much else to see on this drive. A road sign now and then warning drivers to keep gas tanks full and watch out for smoke-filled roads. As reported by my colleague Jacob Bungie, rising temperatures and a longer growing season are making it possible to grow things here, like corn. After hours of driving with instructions like turn right on the only paved road and then go 50 kilometers, I'm greeted warmly by a family in the tiny town of La Crete.
Welcome here.
Thank you very much.
It's not every day that we get company from New York, so
okay.
As they say in Spanish, my house is your house.
You're too kind. Thank you for having me here. Hi.
Okay, I'm Dickie Dreger, farmer up in the Mackenzie region of northern Alberta, the furthest north in North America as far as farming is concerned.
He's been farming here for more than 30 years. Back then, he could only grow Polish canola and wheat.
With the canola, I had a certain amount of success, but the wheat always seemed to freeze. Back in those days, our biggest challenge was too much water. It was quite difficult to get in a crop and have it mature by the first frost in the fall.
But after about a decade, he says things started to shift.
I could feel changes, not so much that it was warming up, but last rain, and I was starting to be more and more of a challenge just to get enough moisture to raise good crops.
In the early 2000s, he says people there started talking about global warming. Droughts got worse, but on the other hand, they could grow different kinds of canola.
It seemed to me that the summers were getting warmer, and my neighbors, instead of the Polish varieties, they were growing Argentine varieties, which can take a lot longer. Drastically increased the yields from about 20 bushels an acre to about 40, I would say, is the average now.
Corn, it remained off the table, though his wife still tried to plant it in the family's garden.
And I told my wife, let's stop this because we're wasting space in the garden. It was just hardly ever a season long enough to get corn even to where we could eat it.
But these days, it's him who's growing the corn. Temperatures around La Crete are 3.5 degrees warmer than in 1950, according to records kept by the Canadian government. It means the growing season is nearly 2 weeks longer. He shows me a chart from the local weather station.
It doesn't look like much if you probably look at just at the data, but if I translate it to corn heat units, I think it's about 25% from, let's say, only 20 years ago.
Enough to get his corn from not even making a cob to reaching its full potential as a feed grain.
So that's a big plus.
Another big change, how crops are transported out of town. For decades, farmers relied on a river crossing. It freezes and becomes an ice bridge, saves a lot of time and fuel.
Usually, at the end of November, we would be going across with small vehicles, and by the end of December, it would be open for full loads, full legal loads.
A legal load is about 60 tons. But in mid-December, the crossing still wasn't open to passenger cars. He says temperatures just haven't gotten cold enough. Something else that's different, he and his wife now have to spray for bugs. Grasshoppers ruined his hay.
Beginning when I was doing cattle, 80% of my winter ration was stored feed in the form of dry forage. And last year is the first year where I didn't even have any forage at all. The only forage that I have fed my cows is bought. But other than that, it's all annual crops, oats and corn, because tend to be able to do better with annual crops in a hotter, drier climate than with forages.
I'm back again the next morning, and it's time to feed the cattle.
Some are always here waiting, and the others are out there, so I have to get them.
So basically, we're out here rounding up the cattle, and it's completely dark. I mean, we're so far north, the days are so short. It's really not that early anymore. I think it's probably 8:30, coming up on 9 o'clock in the morning, and it is pitch black out here.
The darkness is worse than the cold. Sometimes you think it'd be nice to do like the bears do, they hibernate in the wintertime and get up in the spring. Eh?
Just some quiet cows.
Yeah, they don't.
What do they say?
So these are oats. It's a combination of oats and peas in the ration that they're getting fed here.
He has about 500 head of cattle on his land. When temperatures fall below a certain point, he takes steps to keep them from getting too cold. But he says that's happening less often now, too. And like many other farmers in this part of Canada, Dreger is expanding this land to grow more corn and maybe graze more cattle.
And now we're entering a couple of quarters of land that I bought a couple of years ago. When I bought it, it looked like the trees back there.
So it was forest here.
It was forest, yeah. And then first we salvaged the trees that we could, and then the rest of it, that's what I need to burn now, and then I've just got to deal with what's under the ground.
It's dry and windy, and this fire, about the size of a swimming pool, gets large and hot very quickly. He says it'll burn down to the snow.
And it's all debris that the sawmills had no use for. Kind of fortunate that this has to go into the air instead of being utilized all the way, but it is what it is.
So if you think even of what's now called the Corn Belt in the U.S., the northern part of that Corn Belt probably wasn't growing corn for sure 50 years ago and probably not 25 years ago. And so those crops are moving north. And the mix between breeding technology around those crops and changing climate is probably helping the progression. Hi, I'm Joelle Faulkner from Area One Farms. I'm fourth generation Canadian farmer from a dairy farm in London, Ontario.
And she has a background in finance.
And so we invest in areas in Canada where we're looking for both productivity gains on the same crops and areas that will support either more calorie crops and more profitable crops over time. The biggest examples of those would be soybeans and corn. So in a lot of Western Canada right now, it's the kind of fifth highest year ever for the growth of soybeans or for the growth of corn.
The higher productivity is giving land prices a boost, with acres in La Crete selling for nearly five times what they did a decade ago. But when nature is your business, you have to be ready for anything.
So you might have a really, really wonderful spring with lots of rain and really great crop growth. And then, like we did this year in certain parts of Alberta, really early snowfall. And so now your crops are under snow and you haven't been able to harvest them yet. And that kind of variability is tricky because it's really hard or impossible to manage for.
While farmers and investors are watching the farm belt move north on the ground, satellites are recording it from above.
I think we all see that climate change is having an impact on what's being produced and where it's being produced. So it makes sense to track that.
Ian Jarvis is the program director of a group called GeoGlam.
To look for opportunities and also try to understand when issues come up and how they might be addressed.
His work gives a bird's eye view of changes in the world's farmland.
And this technology is going to allow us to better understand what the state of agriculture production is at any time throughout the growing season anywhere in the world. And longer term, it's going to give us an idea of how our agricultural landscapes are going to change so that we can change what we grow, where we grow, and how we grow it to adapt to those changes.
It created a crop monitor, which combines on-the-ground observations with images and data to illustrate changes to agricultural land on an interactive map.
If everything looks like it's going okay in any given year, you'll see green. If there's some reasons for concern, things might be a little wet or seeding might be a little late, there might have been a frost, it could go into a watch.
That's because crop yields might be lower.
And then if things get very severe, and it's usually later in the season when you would see this, you can get a poor rating. And that suggests that things are quite severe and there's probably going to be severe impacts on crop production.
GeoGlam was created by ministers of the G20. That's a forum for governments and central bank governors.
All the pieces are coming together to really have a significant impact on our understanding of agricultural production, how that's changing, and how that interacts with other types of land uses as well. And that is the future, big data.
It helps governments visualize major trends, like the northward expansion of crops in Canada. Other countries are benefiting too, such as Uganda.
In 2017, they were able to use that information to get 3 months early warning on a drought in a portion of their country. And that allowed them to put programs in place to put public works funding to offset some of the food loss. And they actually saved $2.5 million over what they would have cost them to respond after the fact. And they improved the outcomes for 150,000 people approximately. That's just one example, but these examples are popping up all over.
The world's biggest seed companies watch climate trends closely. It affects where they can sell their products and how crops perform in the field. Their research on breeding and genetic engineering aims to let farmers plant in places where the growing seasons have been too short or the temperatures too high.
I think it's important to think about what we've been doing for hundreds, if not thousands of years in breeding as the basis for anything new we're going to do to get resilient crops. I'm Neil Gutterson. I'm the Chief Technology Officer for Corteva. So we are today a division of Dow DuPont, and we are entirely focused on agriculture.
Corteva owns Pioneer. It's one of the world's largest suppliers of genetically engineered seeds. As part of the merger of Dow and DuPont, Corteva will become its own company in 2019.
The essence of breeding is that in nature, plants change their code. Variation arises, mutations happen in nature. People historically, you go back thousands of years, were breeding without intention. You go to the field and you harvest some seed on a rice plant and it's attached to the plant where most of the seed are lying on the ground. And then you plant that seed and it turns out that seed doesn't shatter the way most of the plants did. So you've actually selected for an improvement. That's part of the domestication process. So I gave you an example of selecting unintentionally. Today, we can select very much by design.
Pioneer started breeding corn more than 90 years ago. It has millions of different varieties of the crop. For much of that time, it crossbred corn plants to produce better varieties. Now, crop scientists are matching up varieties based on gene sequences, which researchers have mapped. Corteva is also using a gene editing technology called CRISPR-Cas9. It's often referred to as a molecular scissor, as it lets scientists cut out specific genes. Seedmakers say it could transform agriculture by speeding up evolution, and in the process, help feed more people. But organic farmers and natural food companies say there might be risks to human health, and it could permanently change the natural environment. We're standing outside Dow DuPont's marker lab, where scientists analyze genetic markers from plants.
They're using markers, which are the variations between each of us in our genomes, in our DNA. So that same technology for sequencing and finding variation in the genome is what we use to understand plant variation and to be able to pick varieties that will perform better than others. So we actually sample something in the order of 1 billion data points a year. And a lot of it happens in this marker lab that we'll just step into and give you a little feel for what it's like. This is all part of the marker lab operation, and it's a highly automated process. You see a little shaking over there, because you got to, you know, mix up the samples to get really uniform results.
Scientists are working on experimental crops that mature faster in harsher conditions. They also work with plant diseases. Changing weather patterns mean crops are more susceptible to diseases like Asian soybean rust.
It turns out that for many diseases, you can find a single gene in a plant that will give the plant immunity to that disease. And so the history of plant breeding is full of, okay, you find a gene for resistance, you put it into a plant, you may only get 3 or 4 years of good performance because, like with antibiotics, the pathogen overcomes the resistance in the plant. So how do we help the farmer get more durable resistance and maybe stronger resistance?
Seed companies are automating their research. The goal is to consistently generate and measure data that they say helps them develop crops that perform better.
The nice balmy 78 to 82 degrees inside.
Excellent.
This is one of their large automated greenhouses.
And it starts, you can see here, starts with the soil. Soil is automatically being potted. It's very well designed to deliver the kind of results that we want that mimic how corn would grow in the field.
They use a series of underground tubes and sensors to control the moisture content of the soil.
We had invested over time in creating field stations that could actually create artificially conditions to mimic drought that might be experienced across North America.
So the wheat pots that have just been transplanted are running along a conveyor belt. And as they're running along, sensors are blinking, notifying the belt that they're there to keep the belt running. And they'll round the corner and be met by a large robot with around 4 arms. That robot will then grab the pots in groups of 4, rotate 180 degrees, and drop them onto a large table. My name is John Tunick, and I work here in automation. I manage the automation team here in the greenhouses.
Plants move around the automated system like clockwork. It's all tracked from a central Star Trek-themed hub called the Bridge.
I dream of myself being Captain Kirk. This is my team, and hence the Enterprise that you see. And you can see all of the different tasks that we have set up for the plants throughout the day. And we can monitor their progress. You can see there's a percentage complete in each one. And so we like to think of ourselves in a way as like air traffic controllers. All right, now we're standing in one of our 6 automated greenhouses. And you can hear maybe in the background the hum of the lights right behind this yellow fence that's right in front of us. You'll see what looks like large mechanized fingers that extend out in long rows. And what those do is those actually water our plants. So we run an automatic watering system, and we're able to water those plants via software programming whenever we'd like.
But getting water to crops could prove difficult in the future as water supplies continue to shift alongside weather patterns. Neil Gutterson.
We believe climate change will continue to be a problem and an increasing problem. A lot of models that predict as temperatures rise even 1 or 2 degrees centigrade, the impact on yield will be significant. We have a rice seed business in Asia. We serve the rice market through crop protection products. We think one of the logical changes that will happen over time is less paddy rice, which is very heavily water intensive and produces greenhouse gases, and more focus on direct seeded rice. It'll require more vigorous rice varieties that early in the season can grow even though they don't have a lot of water around. So we are actually working on those kind of systems because there's no question we're going to find ourselves in 10, 20 years needing to have solutions like that where we take account of the fact that water is going to be scarce.
The agricultural industry has positioned technology as the answer to helping farmers cope with climate change as well as the needs of an expanding global population. My name is Jacob Bungie. I'm a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. We're standing outside the Chicago Board of Trade here in downtown Chicago. It's the largest futures exchange operator in the world, where about 1.35 million contracts related to agricultural products ranging from corn to livestock traded on a typical day last year.
Financial futures allow investors to hedge or speculate on a future value. It's a legal agreement to buy or sell something at a particular price. And here is where the whole idea took off. Perched on the rooftop is a statue of the Roman goddess of agriculture and grain.
The agriculture industry is investing billions of dollars each year developing seeds that can grow in harsher conditions and developing software systems that can help farmers place things like pesticides and fertilizer in a more efficient way. They're investing in artificial intelligence that can help them pick the best performing seeds, match them up based on their genes to produce the most food per square acre. They're having a fair amount of success.
Yeah, and everybody's a big data company now.
Right. Farmers and agricultural companies are also sinking a lot of time and effort into data science right now and trying to figure out a way to take all the many, many data points that are generated by a typical year growing crops from the day that the seed's put into the ground, how far into the soil it's inserted, at what time do you apply a pesticide, what the temperature was over the course of the growing season, on which days. All these things they're looking at now and trying to analyze in a way that gives the farmers and the agricultural companies a better guide to what went right and how to replicate that in a more consistent way.
But will people eat it? The success of a product isn't just up to scientists or seed companies. And not everyone is convinced that technology is the answer.
Consumers in developed parts of the world, places like the U.S. and Europe, have been increasingly pushing back on genetic engineering and crops and large-scale livestock production. The things that the agricultural industry likes to hold up as examples of its success, efficiently producing food for as many people as possible.
Even if consumers get on board, will it be enough?
Mother Nature is the ruling force at the end of the day. All of the investments in artificial intelligence and all the investments in satellite imagery and other things that gain more control over crop production, all this still, at the end of the day, is going to be awfully difficult to get around not receiving any real moisture for weeks at a time. The farmers will be dealing with this, the grain companies as well, and the question is whether or not they're going to be able to keep up.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was also reported and produced by Jacob Bungie, Emma Silikens, and Anthony Green. Our technical director is Jacob Gorski. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We're taking a break and look forward to meeting you back here in the new year. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.